This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The United States spends far more on its military than any other country in the world, more than the next 10 countries combined, in fact. And in recent history, leaders and policymakers have suggested that the U.S. may be underusing its diplomacy.
Johns Hopkins professor and Middle East Institute scholar Daniel Serwer makes that argument in his most recent book, Righting the Balance, How You Can Help Protect America. In the book, he proposes diplomacy as a cheaper and more effective solution to solving some of the world's problems. Daniel has spent his career on diplomatic missions around the world, and he joins us now. Professor Serwer, welcome back to Central Time.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, you say that we're all born diplomats. What do you mean by that?
We all try to get the best deal for ourselves, and that's what diplomats try to do for the country.
And in Righting the Balance, you say that we need to do more of that and less military then. Is that the case?
Well, I think we need to combine the two arms that we have. We have a very strong military arm, and we've got a rather weak diplomatic arm. And both would be stronger if they were used more effectively together rather than trying to rely on one or the other separately.
Now, have we always had that imbalance between military and diplomacy in the U.S.? And how we approach the world?
My belief that we have. I tried to find the origins of this imbalance, and I got back to the French and Indian War, and I decided not to go any farther. The United States, we think of ourselves as a peaceful country, but in fact we've been at war for about a quarter of the years that the Republic has existed, and that doesn't count wars against pirates and against American Indians, which of course were very common in the 19th century. So ours is not an entirely peaceful nation, maybe a peace-loving nation, but it's not an entirely peaceful nation. And this imbalance has existed for a long time.
But you're suggesting that it's even worse now than it was before?
I think what's happened is that our military arm has reached the point of diminishing returns. So that as we spend extra dollars on the military, we can buy very little improved performance. And I think we have much more room for improvement for every dollar on the diplomatic side. Not that I'm asking us to spend more on the diplomatic side. In fact, quite to the contrary, I've suggested a major institutional reorganization that would free up money on the diplomatic side and enable us to continue within current budget limits.
Now, can we see, is part of the reason for the whole diplomacy, the less diplomacy, is because the U.S. has a slightly different standing in the world than it used to be? I mean, you know, back in the old days, was it easier for the United States to be a diplomat than it is now?
Well, I don't know if that's really the case. I think what happened was that we got our way in the world. We found it very effective to strengthen our military arm. We projected power farther and farther, and we found it a very effective way to deal with the rest of the world, and it, in some respects, remains that. The problem is that everybody else is looking at us and saying, look, we're not going to challenge you militarily. Mm-hmm. They're challenging us now on the economic front. They're challenging us on the diplomatic front because they see very clearly that our strength on the military front is much greater than theirs. So I don't expect rivals, adversaries, enemies to challenge us militarily for the next 20 years, more than likely. The only real military challenges on the horizon are if we decide that we don't want Iran to get nuclear weapons and need to use military means to prevent it, or if China decides 20 years from now to challenge us militarily. But there are many more challenges in the world today than that, and most of them are better dealt with by civilian means rather than military means.
Is it more difficult to do that, though, when you're thought of as leading with your military force rather than your diplomatic force?
Well, yes, and it's more difficult to do that if you are so practiced on the military side and so poorly practiced on the civilian side. There are countries in this world that punch way above their weight in diplomacy. I think of Norway. I think of Sweden. I'd like to see the United States punching above its weight on the diplomatic side. That would be a world that in which we'd have to spend a lot less and in which we'd be much more effective than we are today.
You keep talking about spending a lot less. What are we wasting money on in the diplomacy area, in your opinion?
The big problem for our diplomats is that most of our diplomatic presence abroad is not our diplomats. The big embassies that we have all over the world are between a half and 90% manned by domestic agencies of the U.S. government, the State Department services, but that aren't actually conducting the essential diplomatic and consular work of the United States. Now, some of them are nevertheless very necessary.
No. Could you explain that to me a little bit more? What exactly does that mean?
That there are domestic agencies presences
abroad. So how does
that? Well, just to give you an example, I was deputy chief of mission of the embassy in Rome. There were 36 different agencies of the United States government stationed there, and I calculated that well over 90% of the presence there was due to non-State Department agencies. That is, it was there. It might be helpful and supportive in our diplomatic work, but it was not the heart of our diplomatic presence, and we could have done without a great deal of it.
So why does it work that way? Why does the State Department have these?
I think there are two reasons, basically. One is legacy. When you win World War II and you have to occupy Western Europe and institute a Marshall Plan for rebuilding, you end up with some very, very large embassies, as we did also after the war in Baghdad, and we will also as we withdraw from Kabul. And so there's a legacy aspect to our very large presences abroad, but there's also inertia. And it is just a whole lot more difficult to end a presence abroad than it is to start one. And that has to change. The State Department has to get much better control over presence abroad and be much more parsimonious about it.
So does this mean that we're in some locations where it would have made sense, you know, say in the 50s, but it doesn't make as much sense now, and there are other parts of the world where we should be that we aren't?
That's exactly right. Our secretaries of state have tried very hard to move our diplomats, and it's proven extraordinarily difficult. Much brighter people than I am have tried to redesign the State Department over the last 30 years, and they're not succeeding. And I think they're not succeeding largely because they're starting with the existing model of bilateral embassies and a whole diplomatic structure that's organized as a static presence abroad. And what we need is a much more agile, much more mobile presence abroad, one that can move from place to place as we require it, but that will fold its tent as quickly as it will set up its tent.
Oh, so basically right now it could be one of those cases where we have a lot of people in one part of the world when we really should have a lot of people in another part of the world then.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, my embassy in Rome will be the first candidate, so far as I'm concerned. We needed many fewer people there. I'm not the first person in charge of that embassy to come to that conclusion. And we need many more people in some very difficult places. And we may not need them to be in big static embassies. They may need to be much more agile and mobile, as journalists are, as some of the private organizations that do reporting from overseas are.
Maybe in the way that the military is.
Also the way the military is, and I'd like to see our diplomats training and deploying with our military forces rather than trying to gin them up to do that 2 weeks before they go abroad.
So why doesn't that happen again? You said there's some bureaucracy involved, but are there other reasons?
I think there's legacy and inertia involved, and a a commitment to a static presence that just no longer suits the world. We need to be able to move our diplomats very quickly, very agilely from one place to another, and they need to be ready and willing to do that. And that's a tall order. I mean, you've got to understand what I'm suggesting is making life very difficult for our diplomats, not easier.
Okay. So there could be some diplomats who would like to stay in a place like Rome rather than going somewhere else.
Oh, there definitely will be, but the fact is that we need them where we need them, and the country has to be able to make those kinds of decisions and to enforce them effectively. That's proven very difficult with the current setup.
Well, we're going to talk more about this in a little bit, a complicated issue, but we'll talk about the whole range of that with Daniel Serwer, a Middle East scholar who thinks the U.S. should focus more on diplomacy rather than the military.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you think the United States should emphasize diplomacy over military might? And do you think the United States should think about focusing less overseas and more on its own shores? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're here with Daniel Serwer, Middle East Institute scholar, talking about his book, Writing the Balance, How You Can Help Protect America, and Increasing Use of Diplomacy Over Use of the Military.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think that the United States should put more emphasis on diplomacy over the military? Do you think the United States should stop worrying about problems overseas altogether? Well, give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And we do have quite a few calls. Professor Serwer, where I'd like to just touch in with you and make sure I'm understanding what you're saying here. Basically, you're suggesting that the diplomatic forces in the United States should be as mobile as the military and they should be used more. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes.
Absolutely.
They should be mobile and agile, ready to go where we need them, when we need them. And we should have a core of people prepared to do that and stop stationing quite so many in fixed embassies abroad where they mostly service the domestic agencies of the U.S. government rather than doing the diplomatic work of the United States.
And that's primarily talking about the State Department activity. And then there's also USAID, which is different, or is that part of the State Department? Help me out with that.
Well, you'll have to ask them whether they're part of the State Department or not. Nobody has ever quite determined that. The fact of the matter is I think we can't afford two separate organizations any longer. They are quite a separate bureaucracy, even if they report through the Secretary of State. And I think that's wasteful, and I don't see any reason for it any longer.
Well, we have a number of people on the line, so we'll just start going to the phone calls, if that's okay with you. Dan from Escanaba, Michigan, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks. You've got a great program. Wisconsin Public Radio is so wonderful. I'd just like to, a comment and a question. And I would agree with your guest. And I had run into a military officer in an airport and had a very good conversation. And he had said at the time that I said, well, how many Pashtun speakers do you have in Afghanistan? And he said, I think there's six, you know, who are actually soldiers in the U.S. military forces, and that is just an absurdity. I agree, you know, that we need more diplomacy. We need to learn other languages and to avoid war. And my question is really, I guess, goes back to Dwight Eisenhower, who warned us of the growing political influence of the military-industrial complex and the profits of war profiteers and their influence over our political process. And I'm wondering, from your point of view, how much is that a role? Is it because the people lobbying Congress don't want peace? They don't want negotiated settlements like in Iran because there's billions of dollars to be made by Lockheed Martin, Martin Marietta, and these other war profiteers? I'd like to I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks, Dan. A couple of good questions there. Daniel Serwer, you want to respond to that?
In my experience, we don't go to war because some company wants us to go to war. We go to war over vital American national interests, and I don't think that's the problem. I do think that the companies have a great deal of influence when it comes to the Pentagon budget, and that one of the reasons for the really quite spectacular growth of the Pentagon budget in the last 10 years has been a very effective lobbying on the part of the companies. Now, mind you, there was a threat to meet. The attack on 9/11 led to a vast increase in our military response, and a lot of mistakes and some good things that have been put in place. But the companies, in my view, don't lobby to go to war. What they do is lobby to increase the Pentagon budget.
What about the point that Dan, or the question Dan made about the number of people who can speak different languages and stuff in the State Department? Is that an issue?
It's a big issue. We are in bad shape in this respect, and the rest of the world is in much better shape because it's sending thousands of students to the United States. The Iraqi government alone is sending over 1,000 government officials per year to the United States for advanced education. We are going abroad less. We are not learning hard languages at anywhere near the rate that's required. Now, this is a little complicated. Study of hard languages is increasing in the United States.
When you say hard, you know, do you mean difficult languages?
I mean difficult languages.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean not French or Italian or Portuguese, the ones I speak, but the really tough ones. And the study of hard languages is increasing fairly rapidly, but from a very, very small base. So we are nowhere near meeting the need for these hard languages. And the rest of the world is much farther advanced in meeting their need to learn English.
Well, we're talking about the imbalance between military and diplomacy with Daniel Serwer. He's a Middle East Institute scholar and professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Brian from Green Bay, thanks for joining us on Central Time. Brian?
I'd like to ask the professor what he thinks of the Peace Corps. I kind of think that's what Sergeant Shriver and President Kennedy were trying to do with that. And just how is the budget of the Peace Corps? The last time I looked, it was minuscule compared to anything else we do for foreign relationships.
Brian, thanks for that call. The Peace Corps, how does that fit into our diplomatic efforts?
I think it's very much part of the diplomatic armatorium, if I can call it that. The diplomatic.
You said
tools
diplomatic armatorium?
Available. The diplomatic tools we have available. Peace Corps is one of those tools. It's not gigantic, but it is very, very useful in relatively permissive environments where there are no active hostilities ongoing, and where the host government welcomes the Peace Corps volunteers. But it's only a piece of a much broader picture of volunteerism and charitable giving abroad. You know, America sends an enormous quantity of money abroad, either as investment or as what are called remittances, money sent home by workers who've come to the United States. And that money has become an extremely important part of financial flows to very poor countries. And so we have a whole lot of tools, and this is part of my point in the book, that, you know, even if you're sitting in your armchair in Oshkosh, you can actually give money, or invest money is more the better way to put it, in small enterprises in Malawi, for example. I've done it on a website called Kiva. There are many others that do it. There are opportunities for Americans to contribute civilian efforts that go far beyond the Peace Corps. Not that the Peace Corps is bad, but it is relatively small. And there are many other opportunities for civilians to contribute to development, to peace building abroad.
So what kind of reaction have you gotten to this? I know that some people thought you were going too far and throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Is that the case, or?
Well, I don't want to be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think, you know, I was motivated to make some fairly radical proposals for rebuilding the State Department USAID from the ground up, largely because I've seen for decades much more moderate reform proposals come to nothing. And we've had four very able secretaries of state in a row now, each one of which has tried to, in one way or another, reform the State Department, though what John Kerry will do in that respect is not yet entirely clear. And they've largely failed. And they've largely failed, I think, because the system that exists is a very consolidated institutional system that needs radical reform and can't be done at the margins.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about it today. Daniel Serwer is the Middle East Institute scholar and professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. You can read more about this. You can get his recent book, which is called Righting the Balance: How You Can Help Protect America. Thanks so much for joining us.